Most bankers aren't ready to help you until after their third cup of coffee. But with Central National Bank's after-hours service, you don't have to wait for the bank lobby to open to get help. You can contact us from 6 to 8:30 in the morning or from 5 to 10 in the evening, and we'll connect you to a real, live, local person who can answer questions and fix problems 7 days a week. Bank different. Bank Central. Central National Bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome once again to Trail Daddy. I'm Dave Deckard talking about your Portland Trail Blazers, and thank goodness they're your Portland Trail Blazers because I'm not entirely sure anyone else wants them at this point. We are glad to have you along for the ride, though. The season is over. We are still podcasting. I'm not quite up to doing weekly yet, but we're getting as close as we can. And now that the campaign is finished, 82 games of what really ended up being kind of a lost year are done. It's time to take account. It's time to look back. And the way we're going to do that first is simply going through some of the questions that you've submitted. As you know, it's been a long time feature I've done, the Blazers Edge mailbag. I try to answer as many questions as possible, but usually we do one a day on site, if that. And we try to cover them thoroughly, but that is a slow pace. So I thought today we'd try to pick up a few more than that and answer them maybe in more summary fashion, but so you can get an idea what people are asking out there, and also those of you who ask can get some answers. So we're going to concentrate on a couple of topics, really, but we will try to get a variety of questions here. You'll have to excuse me because I'm reading these real time, so if I have to pause for a second, that's why. But we're going to start out with an overview question, and that is simply, what do I think is the story of the year? Dave, what do you think is the story of the year? This is Mark. No, excuse me, Marco. Sorry, Marco. The story of the season for the Trailblazers for me has got to be Scoot Henderson. Now, there were ups and downs, and it's a multifaceted, complex story, but I think the overarching theme is, wow, a dicey third overall pick in a year when the Blazers needed some reassurance and some surety. Now, I am not saying that Scoot won't get there. In fact, here are the things I like about Scoot. Obviously, his physical presence, his work ethic, I think is good. I think he did show capacity to grow over the course of the season, and that was great. Now, everybody's pointing out his last 20 games, and fair enough. I think that he did well, but you have to be careful, and here's why. Those last 20 games, nobody took the Blazers seriously, and anybody who did take the Blazers seriously absolutely blew them out. And look, it's not to take away from Scoot. I think he did fine. But there's a big difference playing in pressure-filled NBA basketball where the team is concentrating on your team and on you in particular and bearing down on you than there is going out there and basically playing scrimmages. Now, I'm not saying that they were entirely scrimmaging. They did count. The games did count. But by that point, the Trailblazers were a non-factor. No one was coming in with their A game. And, you know, you have to differentiate. When things mattered, when the pressure was on, Scoot didn't look great. When the pressure came off and it looked a little bit more like the G League Ignite, he flourished. Now, I think there were some defined skills that really did improve. I thought his decision-making got better, marginally at least. His dribbling skills are obviously awesome. He didn't get to use the change of direction as much as I'd hoped he would during the season. But in those last games, I think you saw a little bit more variety in his offense. And look, again, I'm playing this up because I think he has natural ability and skills to succeed. Whether he will live up to the third overall pick will be an interesting question, or whether he becomes one of those marginal players, one of those Jared Bayless type players that has a lot of hype around him. And obviously Bayless was picked lower, but has a lot of hype around him, and you can see the flashes, and he makes a career in this league. But it's always a die roll and never stops being a die roll whether he's going to actually flourish on a given night. I think there's a real possibility that Scoot ends up as that kind of guy. I think there's a possibility he also ends up as a starter that is solid enough and has some defined roles like defense, like penetration, that kind of thing, the pull-up game, obviously. I wish the Blazers could run more. I mean, that might show him off. But the window for him becoming a superstar, the way he was advertised, it seems narrower. It just does. And you look at the three-point percentage, I mean, 32.5%, that's actually a stark improvement from where he started. That's not fantastic. One would hope that would go up. One would hope he could look at it, but that isn't there, right? Worse, though, his 38.5% overall field goal percentage for a guy who's expected to drive the offense. And even worse than that, 3.4 turnovers per game doesn't seem that bad. I mean, it's bad, but you go like, okay, if I squint, I could almost see that if he shaves a little bit off. But he only played 28.5 minutes per game, which means he was averaging per 100 possessions, it was 5.9 turnovers per 100 possessions. In other words, 6% of his possessions ended up turning the ball over. That's not good for an NBA point guard. And combined with not being able to shoot the three, those are two deadly offenses. I mean, what do NBA point guards do now? They shoot and they get you a high percentage offense. They get the ball distributed. You want people who take care of the ball and can hit the three. And he can't do either, at least not at this point. So if he's going to be a superstar point guard in this league at this time in this era, he's literally missing the two most important skills that this era values. That's a tough road. That's a tough hill to climb. Now, could Scoot redefine an era? Possibly. I would like to see his defense continue to improve. I would like to see him be able to use his body better. And most of all, he's got to curb those turnovers. That's never going to be acceptable. You can't lose 6% of your possessions in a game and prosper. NBA games are decided by a margin of victory of plus or minus 4 points for most teams. I mean, a large swath of the teams fall within that margin. A super good team will get up to plus 9, plus 10. Absolutely terrible teams will be at minus 9, minus 10. But a lot of people live in that middle ground, yeah? And every turnover that you commit is, at least theoretically, a shot that you did not get to attempt. And then a lot of them end up in shots that the opponent does get to attempt, and some of those end up being easy shots. And if you go minus 6 for you and plus 6 for the opponent on shot attempts, or even take away the minus 6 on shot attempts, and let's say you'd make half of them or 40% of them, you're really talking around 3 or 4 points per game minimum you're giving up just from your starting point guard position. And that's almost a margin of victory right there. That takes you from a win to dead even just in one player, one possession, or one position, rather. So that can't happen. And we've seen very little evidence that Scoot has learned to curb those. So it's his first year. It was a whirlwind, and it was in some ways a nightmare. But all I know is when he was playing with veteran players who should have been easy enough to set up with the offense that the team wanted, he was committing a ton of turnovers. His play, his personal play, improved when those veteran players sat and when he was one of essentially 3 to 5 rookies who were playing and the reins came off. And that's great. He might be among the best of those untried rookies that the Blazers actually have. But his turnovers still didn't calm down. That's the number one thing that's got to happen. And so I think for me, that's the story of the season, because it's not just lacking expectations or not meeting expectations from a third overall pick, which, by the way, is the other thing you have to do. I think I've mentioned this before. You have to reset on Scoot in order to see the rose-colored glasses view. You have to look at Scoot on Scoot's terms as if that pick was already executed. This is the player you got. You judge him only against himself. Fair enough, because that's the only way you can really judge players. But if you look at him against the pantheon of third overall picks, or what you'd expect of a third overall pick, that gets a lot harsher. But here's the thing, and here's why it's the story vis-a-vis or based on the draft. That was one of the super premium picks that the Blazers will get in this whole rebuilding process. And then don't worry, they'll probably have more. But there's no lock solid guarantee that they'll ever be top three again. And there's certainly not a guarantee that they're going to repeat in top three a whole bunch. This was a big opportunity to start over with a bang at this time in 2023-2024. If Scoot doesn't turn out to be a star, then they did not do that. They basically put the rebuild on hold for another year. And they have other players coming up, but none with the promise and advertised potential of Scoot Henderson. And also, all of them have their share of problems and question marks too. And you know what? Wasting a season in a rebuild might not be as egregious as wasting a season in a championship window, but it's certainly as egregious as wasting a season, say, of Damian Lillard's prime when you're stuck in the middle and all those years we complained about Neil Olshey and the Blazers just weren't making moves and were winning 40x games again and again and again. Well, this rebuild situation is as dire as that. It was their first year at it, but it still counts. And putting off that rebuild, Control-Alt-Deleting and rebooting into another season is not a trivial matter. So, that to me is the story of the season, long story short. Another question. Let's see what we've got. This one is from Joab. Oh, it says, pick up a big like AD, Anthony Davis. We need a dependable backup to assist our team, passing shot blocker to help our core players. Well, that would be nice, right? But here's the thing. Where is that player? Here's the situation with bigs nowadays. And it's funny. It's multifaceted. And everybody should listen to this. It's really hard to draft a big now for a few reasons. One of which is the initial entry time of star NBA players has gone down to 19 years old. And it may go down to 18, depending on whether players are able to be drafted out of high school. First of all, people aren't done growing at that age entirely. Second of all, with centers especially, power forwards a little bit, but centers, you know, 7-footers, it usually takes them 3 or 4 seasons to acclimate. Okay? At 18 or 19, you know physical gifts and potential, but unless it's super obvious, you don't really know what a guy is fully capable of, which makes it first disguises it if they're not a Victor Wembanyama, right? But also it makes it harder because that guy's going to go through, if you draft an 18-year-old big or a 19-year-old big, that guy's going to go through most of his rookie contract before you even figure out how good he is. Okay? So even if you make the initial pick, you have to wait on that player. And as you're waiting on that player, you have to face a couple more realities. First of all, the American system is not as good at developing seven-footers as we once were. Part of that is because the game has changed and the demands on seven-footers are incredibly high. Used to be, if you had a good post game and could rebound, you could probably make it. If you were a shot blocker and had some size or physicality to you, you were gold. Okay? Nowadays, teams are running from players like that. And Andre Drummond could barely get drafted now. Because the last thing that coaches want in the modern NBA is anyone who's going to get in the middle, clog up that space, demand possessions, and slow down the ball. Somewhere along the line, we figured out a couple things. Number one, number of possessions can trump quality of possessions, at least in terms of field goal percentage. And number two, well, and especially since there's a 2A to that, since we don't defend well anymore, since the NBA rules have loosened up on defense, all possessions look like quality possessions. It used to be, if an NBA big man could shoot 50% in the post, that was way better than your guard at 42%. There are still plenty of guards that shoot 42%, but you know what? If you work real hard, you can get up to 47. And that's pretty close to 50. And here's the second thing. It takes a lot less time for a guy to shoot from the outside or make a move than it does for that guy in the post to set up, seal off, catch, employ good footwork, maybe a couple fakes and a spin, and put the ball in. And you're getting, what, 3 percentage points advantage on that? You know what? Coaches don't want it. And that's the second big point, is that you figure out that the three-pointer and those guards shooting it ends up making, you know, a huge difference. You only have to shoot 33% on a three-point arc in order to equal 50% in the paint. And then the shots come up a lot quicker and more frequently, so you're getting quantity of shots with a lower percentage that actually produce way more points than quality of shot at a lower rate of shooting. So basically, big guys now have to not only go out and set picks, but they're expected to be somewhat of a face-up option, at least out to mid-range on the side, because we want them out of the lane. But also, many of them to three-point land. You want your stretch five. You want the guy to be able to hit out there. Also, on defense, a big man has to go out and cover the three-point arc, which we're talking about mobility. So you're talking about a lot of lithe, tall, rangy guys with a lot of skills rather than bulky guys who are going to post up in the lane. And guess what? All of those skills also take longer to develop, and they are rare. I mean, a guy who can do all of, there's a reason Victor Wembanyama is being heralded as a potential GOAT. I mean, he was even before he was drafted. But even in year one, I've heard people say, this is the one year maybe he won't make an all-NBA team, and he's going to make it forevermore. Because he has all of those skills. And that's a really super rare thing. Another thing that I think is missed is that, and again, this may be era-bound, maybe it wouldn't matter, but there was a guy back in the day named Pete Newell, and he was an ex-college coach and an NBA developmental coach, and he used to run a camp, and you would send your big man to him. And almost every big man in the league at one time or another went to Pete Newell's camp. And he would take however many he did a year. It wasn't a huge number, but it was enough to where you could rotate all the centers through it. And he would teach big men how to play. He would teach big men footwork. He would teach them how to use their arms, how to use their leverage. He was brilliant. This was literally his niche. This is how he made his living. And he was famous. Maybe his system wouldn't work anymore, but you don't have that Pete Newell out there in American basketball anymore. And you don't have your go-to camp the same way to send your big guys to teach them how to play. So not only is it taking longer and do you have more skills to develop and you have to draft them younger so you're taking more of a risk, you also don't have the traction when they get going that they used to. Which is why I think in many ways, and I think this is absolutely demonstrable because you can look at the NBA draft and 7-footers or really tall guys, where are they coming from? They're coming from Europe. They're coming from Europe where they've spent years and years in a professional system because you can start younger there. And they've been trained in and disciplined in these skills by coaches who know fundamentals. And yes, they're concerned about winning, but Europe is a little bit of a different animal. There's still a little bit of, bias toward the basics there that you don't get in, let's say, American AAU basketball, where coaches will play the same players for the entire game and just let them run in order to win. And you know what? In college, somewhat, not entirely the same way, but come on. Who are your famous blue chip college coaches? It's not the same now as it was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, it was predicated on sustained winning. It was predicated on being able to develop players. Now it's being able to recruit those guys who will stay for 1 year and then go to the NBA and have a flashy year and then being able to turn it around next year. And player development takes a back seat, if at all, because you know what? When you get that guy, A, you only have him for 1 year. B, you want to showcase him so other, you know, 1 year players will come to your system. And C, you're more concerned about the way you look and the way your program looks than the fundamentals with which these guys actually play. And you're not going to cheese them off either. You're not going to discipline them. You can't recruit a 1 year player and then discipline him by not playing him. He's got to be really bad for that to happen. Otherwise, you're holding up a big sign to other potential recruits saying, don't come here. You're going to blow it. You're not actually going to make it to the NBA or your stock is going to be devalued. So we don't have the infrastructure and developmental system for big men anymore that we used to. And it is starting to show. And if you look at the three best bigs in the NBA, who are they? Nikola Jokic, yeah, Joel Embiid, and also Victor Wembanyama. And all of them have at least some connection with overseas play, right? All of them have at least some connection with not necessarily growing up in the American system. And that should bring us pause. And that should also cause us to wonder about whether we are doing this right, at least if it applies to the 7-footer. Now, I should say Embiid, of course, is from Cameroon. He played in Florida high school and he played in Kansas, so he's a little bit of the exception. But there's at least a shadow there. I'm pretty down on the U.S. right now when it comes to 7-footers, and I think that makes it harder. Last thing I'll say about this, it also doesn't help that the Blazers themselves, their two highest players are DeAndre Ayton and Jeremy Grant, highest paid players, I mean. And that doesn't help. I mean, yes, of course, you draft a young guy, but they've also got these players under contract for Ayton at least a couple more years, and Grant is like 4. And you're paying them a ton of money. So the Blazers have to at least somewhat figure that they are rolling the dice with these guys, especially since they gave Grant a new contract. That would never stop them from drafting a star, of course. But they're not going to bank on rebuilding the system of bigs. I think they're going to try to get by with recruiting, you know, free agency, mid-level big, or making a trade that brings somebody they like. And I don't think they're going to go through the draft process with a seven-footer until it's proven that A, it'll work, and B, they really need it. All right. We have Bradley. Oh, this is an interesting one. I can't believe how many morons are out there that say Chauncey Billups should go. You could have Phil Jackson or any Hall of Fame coach you can think of there last year. I've never seen a team hammered with injuries as much as I've seen the Blazers last year. The first team that's ever started five rookies. And he goes on and says they're playing hard, and if they're healthy and they have talent, then Chauncey will look okay. Now, obviously the Blazers are in a rebuild, and obviously it's true that if they put more talent on the team, they are probably going to get better. The injury excuse is also valid, although there's, you know, some gray area there. How much do players come back? How much do you actually want to play them? What incentive? In fact, you know, you could say it both ways, and I know this isn't completely balanced, but if you played the starters more, you would see less from guys like Banton and like Kamara and even Walker. And your bright hopes that you thought Chauncey developed actually probably wouldn't be developed as well. Scoot Henderson, we already talked about, he's the one exception to that. But you know what? It's the Blazers did not excel even when they had most of their team healthy. They didn't look coordinated. They didn't look effective. And their defense was never there. Now, you can say some of that's personnel. I'm not sure I trust DeAndre Ayton, honestly, defensive. Jeremy Grant is good, but he needs people to link to. That wasn't there. Kamara looked good, and he tried hard, but, you know, he's also not enough. And the guards never stepped up. So you got at least three positions of deficit there, unless you put in Matisse Thybulle. I'm not sure that that's entirely coaching, but I thought they could have done better. They broke down, they miscommunicated, they never seemed to have the right hand knowing what the left hand was doing. That is often, not always, but often a sign of coaching. The offense took an awful long time to get steady, and I understand that there were different focuses that at the beginning that they wanted to go with the wings. And at the beginning, it was Shaedon Sharpe when he was there. And Anfernee Simons as well. That makes sense because both of them should be natural scorers. But Jeremy Grant stepped up midseason when they went down, and then it became his team. But DeAndre Ayton wasn't really in there until after the All-Star break, and Jeremy kind of went down, and then Ayton stepped up. And I get that some of that was a natural progression, but those players are not good enough to be either or. And in fact, I would say that the coaching challenge of running an offense featuring the one player who's obvious is not a huge coaching challenge at all. That almost anybody could do that. And in fact, I was kind of upset that the Blazers waited so long to really lean on Ayton and see what he could do, because he was one of the bright hopes for the team that maybe you can get more out of him than Phoenix did. And they ended up not on average, in part because I think they waited on the experiment too late. But it's not a huge challenge to feature one guy. It's a huge challenge to get a lot of guys clicking together. Again, Chauncey gets an asterisk because his point guard was brand new, and like we said, turning over the ball and et cetera, et cetera. I understand all of that. But somehow, honestly, I still found myself wanting more. And I think that as the mid-season unwound, not even the collapse at the end of the season, you could see that coming. And by the way, I think some of that would have happened, injuries or no. But in the midseason, the Blazers were already kind of sputtering. And they'd have a game that was brilliant and then one or two that just you couldn't understand. You were head scratched. And then it started devolving from there where more of those games looked like not real basketball. Till where at the end, by the time we got to March, whatever else was happening with individuals, the team as a whole was a complete non-entity. It was almost like they weren't even playing basketball out there. Now, I respect Chauncey Billups as a player, and I understand he knows more about basketball than I ever will. But as a coach, this wasn't it. And last year kind of wasn't it. And his first year was only sort of it. And my question is, as always, how many years do you go with this repetition? I said in a written article, I'm okay with all these questions heading into a coach's second year. We're heading into his fourth year. And the only reason I can see conclusively to keep him, even with everything you've said, Bradley, is simply not to pay someone else. And because next year it's not going to make a difference again. But I will lean back on something I just said about draft, that these rebuilding years do count in terms of establishing forward momentum for the team. And if the Blazers, granted they're not going to win next year, they're not going to win big, they're not even going to make 500 as is. You can't forecast that with a straight face. But if they don't make progress, if they don't have definition and continuity and some kind of team culture and identity, you end up spending years and years. And keep in mind, we spent a minimum of 2 years winding down the Dame era. And people wanted to plug their ears and go, la, 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 la. But you know what? The last 2 years of Damian Lillard's career were about featuring Damian Lillard and rolling the dice and taking a chance. They were not about building up the team and a culture and continuity. It was Dame or bust. And honestly, it was kind of like that even before that. But you've spent a minimum of 2 years kind of pinning all your hopes on Dame, which is not a culture and is not a plan. It is a hope that centers around a player who obviously is no longer there. So you have no cultural carryover from that, no tradition of excellence, no definition of the team or the franchise or whatever it is. And then you have 2 years of stalling, 2 years of no progress, no winning, no whatever. That's 4 years now of nothing. And you know what? If you look at the franchises that have flatlined in the NBA, in NBA history, and I got to watch several of them. You look at the old Los Angeles Clippers. You look at the up until recent vintage Minnesota Timberwolves. Even when Karl Anthony Towns was first there, they had a spike with Kevin Garnett for a while. But before Kevin and after Kevin, he was kind of like Dame to them. Before and after him, they had no direction. They had no culture. They had draft picks. They had GMs. They had coaches. But they didn't have any momentum. There was no reason to go to or to think about Minnesota. Charlotte Hornets under Michael Jordan, similar, okay? And it's not just going through a rebuild or a down period. It's going through a rebuild or a down period in the dark, in the fog. And that's literally where the Blazers are right now. As much spin as you want to put on it, as much as people want to hope, as much as people want to justify the decisions. And I can do that too. I know intellectually and analytically exactly why they are where they are. And I can tell you why each of the moves in isolation made sense. I'm not blind to that. But if you look at it as a whole, this team is closer to being directionless, amorphous, blob, just absolutely no account as an NBA franchise, nothing to distinguish it or define it, as they have been, honestly, since they were an expansion team. Even in 2005, they had a tear-apart mandate. And they, as I've said before, they got to resurrect in 2006. They got real lucky with their draft picks, which is what they have to hope happens again. But they don't have that defining culture anymore. And it was evident. It was there after the championship. It was there after the Drexler years. It was there even during the Rasheed Wallace years. Up until the Jailblazers years was the first time they lost it. They got it back with Roy Aldridge. And Damian Lillard kind of disguised its decline because he was so great and charismatic. But when he left, there was nothing underneath, and there's been nothing to replace it. And I think that my beef is less with Chauncey Billups as an individual, perhaps, although I'm not impressed at this point, but more that he is yet another piece of that puzzle that just won't go together. The puzzle piece is literally lying on the table, and you're hoping you have the right ones, but you don't have anything linked together. You don't have any direction or momentum. And Billups, at the very least, isn't helping that. And so I don't know if a coaching change fixes that. It's too big of a problem for one solution or one direction to take care of. But I do know that this isn't helping. And I do know that, at least for me, I would have seriously considered moving on. Now, I know they can't get a coach that everybody's going to rally around. But I think at least a change in momentum somewhere, given that the next 2 years are going to be rocky, would at least be a change in momentum. And I really don't know, unless they pin their hopes on what is reputed to be a weak draft. I can see hope for 2 years from now, and I can see hope for 5 years from now because of the draft picks they're going to get and swaps with Milwaukee. But hope for next year? I'm having a real hard time finding it, and I worry that the Blazers will too, and spend another year in the swamp without really doing anything about it. All right, well, that's my time for now. We'll probably come back either next week or soon and answer some more mailbag questions, because I had at least four or five queued up. I talked too long, but that's the way it goes. Thanks for listening to Trail Daddy. Listen to all the other podcasts coming up on Blazers Edge 2. We have rejuvenated our podcast suite, and there are regular podcasts happening. You can find them wherever you found this one, or of course look on site, blazersedge.com, and we post them as they come up. I am Dave Deckard. Thank you so much for being with us, and go Blazers! At least go somewhere.